Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We don't know what Congress is going to do to help out this economy, so we created our own relief package. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 2nd of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, every now and then it can be instructive to play a little what if with the news. So we will. The news at issue for us today, as it has been for a while now, is what, if anything, Congress is going to do to help this economy as CARES Act money runs out, virus counts rise, and whatever recovery there was stalls. There is talk, not much more than that, on Capitol Hill about some kind of short-term relief. What there is not is agreement. So we had Marketplace's Sabri Benishore ask a couple of economists, what if this package was up to you?
Everyone seems to agree on fighting the virus, at least.
We need to make sure that we have enough funding to deal with public health measures to combat the virus.
Michael Strain is a labor economist with the American Enterprise Institute. Funding for public health and vaccination is in all the proposals on the table, Democratic, Republican, bipartisan. Vincent Deluar is a markets guy. He's a macro strategist for financial services group StoneX. Here's his take on coronavirus relief.
The single biggest item down the list is the unemployment benefits, because this is something where people are going to really suffer.
Senate Republicans' plan would extend some unemployment aid for a month. Democrats haven't released details, but previous plans wanted to extend for longer. The bipartisan plan would shell out an extra $300 in unemployment per week for 4 months. Constance Hunter is chief economist at KPMG. She has got the business angle.
There should be grants to businesses, not loans. There are many businesses that really need fiscal assistance, or they're not going to be there when we start having the vaccine widely distributed.
Grants should also go to people, says Justin Wolfers, professor of economics at the University of Michigan.
Unlike previous recessions, we should really design the package around income support for the millions of people who are still either without work or on incredibly reduced hours.
The Republican plan and the bipartisan plans don't include stimulus checks and don't say anything about grants to businesses, but they would add $300 billion to the Paycheck Protection Program. Democrats have been favorable to more stimulus checks. Wolfers and Democrats also want money for state and local governments. That is exactly what Chris Edwards, economist at the Cato Institute, does not want.
I'm particularly against more bailout money for state and local governments. State and local government revenues are actually pretty solid.
That has long been a point of contention between Republicans and Democrats. So far, the compromise everyone has made has been to do absolutely nothing. Only in Washington is that a compromise. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Only in Washington. Turns out Brits are going to be the first to get a fully tested coronavirus vaccine. Regulators over there approved distribution this morning. First shots next week for healthcare workers. Over here, meanwhile, logisticians are taking over because it is going to take all kinds of coordination to get the vaccine to everybody. The obvious places to get your shots are going to be doctor's offices and pharmacies, right? Also, possibly, as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, workplaces as well.
Think of this working like those flu shot days lots of companies host every fall. The boss brings the vaccine to you because maybe you're a little busy or forgetful or whatever.
It turns out that we're really bad at following through on our intentions.
Katie Milkman researches behavior and health at the Wharton School.
And that's going to be, I think, one of the biggest challenges related to this vaccine.
Making vaccines more convenient is the most effective way to get more people to take them. And Dan Salmon, who directs the Institute for Vaccine Safety at Johns Hopkins, says it would help establish trust if health professionals could give vaccines in the workplace.
Often they give stickers that say, hey, I got vaccinated. So that's helping to create social norms. And social norms are really very important.
The COVID vaccine could be given at places like offices and malls and universities. But that would come with some challenges. The Pfizer vaccine has to be stored at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit, a bit colder than the break room freezer.
And plus it's two doses, so they have to come back for the second dose. So it really would take a lot of planning.
Claire Hannon directs the Association of Immunization Managers. She says by the time we reach mass distribution, there may be versions of the vaccine that are easier to store and administer.
So hopefully there'll be better options than trying to lug an ultra-cold freezer into the workplace.
Hannon thinks if employer-sponsored vaccinations do happen, they'll become so popular that the biggest hurdle won't be these logistics, but finding enough healthcare professionals to keep up with demand. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a whole lot of nothing. By the bell, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, banks. They are doing fine, as they usually are doing. But a report out this week from the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, caught our eye. Banks are, among other things, lenders. And the FDIC says lending volume fell in the most recent quarter, driven by decreases in commercial and industrial lending. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what's going on.
Companies normally use bank loans to grow their businesses, maybe build a new factory or acquire another business. But Drew Pasquarella at Cornell University says that kind of activity hasn't fully recovered.
Mergers and acquisition volume in the U.S. is down 30% year over year.
Pasquarella says companies also use bank loans to raise cash for a rainy day. That happened a lot at the outset of the pandemic.
The companies that had existing relationships with banks, they ran to the banks and tried to borrow as much money as they could.
In the time since, that kind of panic borrowing from banks has calmed down, says Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics.
Companies felt more secure that the world wasn't coming to an immediate end.
But Petru says the economy is still shaky, and the idea of taking on more bank loans doesn't seem prudent for a lot of companies, even with interest rates near record lows.
No matter what the interest rate is, if you're a corporate borrower, you need to pay it back.
When bigger companies have needed cash, they've been raising it from investors by issuing bonds. Those have longer payoff periods than bank loans and come with fewer conditions, says Matteo Arena at Marquette University.
So as bonds are more attractive, right, then there's less need for going to a bank for a new loan.
But smaller companies don't have the option of issuing bonds. Arena says those companies are borrowing less from banks because many of them are going out of business. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Give them 7.5 minutes. They will give you the world. David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report. Check them out. Fed Chair Jay Powell and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin were back on Capitol Hill this morning talking again, as we told you they did yesterday, about their differing views of this economy. Mnuchin generally more positive, Powell more pragmatist, pointing out this morning, the Fed Chair did, that tens of millions of people are still out of work and that absent some kind of relief from Congress, lasting damage will be done. And that, the lasting damage, is where we go now. And a word that economists use that is important to understand here.
It's pronounced hysteresis.
That's Danny Yagan. He's associate professor of economics at UC Berkeley with a vocabulary lesson.
In hysteresis, you have a big shock like a recession, and then you fix what caused the recession, but the workers are still affected.
Yeah, but the word itself, though?
It comes from physics.
Wait, physics?
You know, I looked this up some time ago. The Wikipedia article is extremely confusing.
As Wikipedia tends to be, right? Here is the quote from that source of all information. Hysteresis occurs in ferromagnetic and ferroelectric materials, as well as in the deformation of rubber bands and shape memory alloys.
So hysteresis actually means delayed or lagging behind.
That is Dr. Elizabeth Green. She is a condensed matter physicist at the National High Magnetic Field Laboratory. It is in Tallahassee, Florida. And she is going to explain hysteresis, this term that means delayed or lagging behind, because it's going to help us understand what happens to an economy after a big shock like the one we are in the middle of right now.
I personally, in my research, we use this term a lot to refer to magnetization.
Go on.
If you're holding a piece of iron, the piece of iron itself will not likely be magnetized.
Right, but how come?
And the reason is because those magnetic moments in the iron are pointing all different directions.
Okay, so think of this unmagnetized piece of iron as the economy before the shock. All the workers and all the companies going about their business in all different directions.
But when we do start applying an external parameter, in this case, an external magnetic field, we can start magnetizing this piece of iron.
That external magnetic field is a big shock.
And if we remove that external field, the iron will still remain magnetized.
There is a delay, a lag. The shock that caused the change is gone, but it takes a while for the iron to go back to its normal unmagnetized state.
Nature is lazy. It likes to stay in a particular state. It does not like change.
Neither, it turns out, does the economy like change. Here's Danny Yagan at UC Berkeley again.
In economics, we have a recession. You know, COVID shuts down the economy.
A big shock.
And then once we solve COVID, the economic effects linger. People are worried and businesses are worried that the jobs and customers won't be there. And so you dip your toes back in the water slowly.
For instance,
think of a restaurant coming out of COVID and it's deciding how much of their wait staff to rehire.
There were 10 million people working in bars and restaurants in this economy in October, 12 million back in February. And by the time vaccines get to everybody, there are going to be people in that industry who will have been out of work for a year.
And now that they are getting back to work, they're building back up their savings. They're not spending in a restaurant. And so the restaurant owner is smart to say, I won't have full capacity in my restaurant for a while. And so there are a bunch of people who still aren't working at restaurants.
As we know, spending by or on behalf of consumers, come on, say it with me now, you know what's coming, accounts for 70% of this economy. And eventually, the people who did get rehired are going to start spending again.
So now the restaurant owner hires some more wait staff back, and then those wait staff go and spend all that money on other restaurants, and then you get back in this virtuous cycle, but it just doesn't happen instantaneously.
Nature and the economy are lazy. So even after the shock that caused the change has gone, it is going to take a while for this economy to rebound. Hysteresis is today's word of the day. Thanks again to economist Danny Yagan at UC Berkeley. Also physicist Elizabeth Green at the National High Magnetic Field Laboratory. Coming up.
Whenever I sell a car, which thankfully isn't too often, it's a massive wrench in my life.
A vintage car enthusiast in the age of electric vehicles. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials ticked up 59 points today, about 0.2%, finished at 29,883. The NASDAQ essentially flat, 12,349. The S&P 500 picked up 6 points, about 0.1%, 36.69. Justin Ho was telling us about commercial loans, so let us head to the banks. J.P. Morgan Chase vaulted up 1.9%. Citigroup deposited more than 3% today. The FDIC report on banks we talked about, by the way, also contained this nugget of real economy information. The value of loans that were 90 days or more past due increased by nearly 8% in the third quarter of this pandemic year. Salesforce, as I mentioned briefly in this spot on the program yesterday, announced it's buying our work-from-home water cooler substitute Slack for about $27 billion. That's a lot more than Slack's estimated revenue for next year. So Salesforce today, down 8.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. As I was saying a little bit ago, there were about 2 million fewer jobs in bars and restaurants in October than there were before the pandemic, which means there are a whole lot of unemployed bartenders and waitstaff competing for the jobs that are left. That's people like Neil Cairns, one of the 10 who we've been following in our series about the American labor force. It's called The United States of Work. The bar in Portland, Oregon, where Neil worked, closed temporarily in the spring. It reopened in the summer and then shut its doors for good in August. Neil, it is good to talk to you again.
Pleasure to be back.
How are you, first of all?
I'm doing all right, all things considered. Right now, I am applying for jobs. Still looking for work. I've done a couple of interviews, but the interviews have been kind of intense. I've heard from a few different people that they've had, more than 100 applicants to a single job. There's just a lot of people applying for not a lot of jobs. So
what are you going to do, Neil?
That's a really good question. My landlord's been working with us on things like rent and stuff like that. We've actually been paying half rent for a few months now. But, he's also made it clear that come January, we need to be paying full rent or he needs to find somebody else to rent to. So I really don't know what I'm going to do coming up here.
I'm sure you're paying attention to the eviction moratorium that expires at the end of the year. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely looming quickly. So,
Are you getting unemployment benefits? I remember at some point we had talked to you and it was really tough for you to actually even get those benefits that you were due. Have you been able to fix that?
So yes, recently I did finally start receiving regular unemployment. I've gotten the back pay for it. So that has finally come together. I am actually getting $152 a week for unemployment.
I'm sorry, $152 a week?
Yeah.
That's not going to cover probably even half rent, right?
No, not remotely. No, that's, there were nights I made that much as a bartender. So
this is kind of a sideways question, but go with me here. We talk on Marketplace a lot about uncertainty in business and how that affects what businesses do. It seems to me that this is uncertainty on an extremely personal level. You don't know where you're going to be living in January. You don't know where money's coming from. There are millions of people in this economy like you. I'm amazed you have the wherewithal to get on the phone and talk to me.
Well, I think it's important that it's clear that people know that this is going on. I'm certainly not alone in it. Like you said, I mean, there are millions of people across the country who are going through exactly the same situation as me, and plenty who've got it, even harder. So,
do you feel like you've been forgotten?
I'm not sure I was ever noticed in the first place in this economy. I think that we've been trying to do a whole lot of different, like, kind of half measures to take care of this pandemic. And a lot of that has ended up with people like me, I think, being forgotten.
What does a solution look like to you? I mean, if Congress came out today and said, we've got $3 trillion, how would you want them to spend it?
I think they need to really fully, properly lock down the country and pay people to stay the heck home. A few weeks of a real proper lockdown for any non-essential person, where people don't need to worry about making ends meet, and we'd have a much simpler problem to deal with.
So this is kind of a personal question, but are you sleeping well at night?
No, I don't go to sleep. I wake up a lot. I have really explicit Disney-esque nightmares about needing to get a job. Like literally just having people in my dreams tell me, you're worried because you need to get a job. Like, I don't even have the energy to be creative right now. That's neat.
It doesn't need a whole lot of analysis. It just tells you what it's all about. I don't want to end on a downer, Neil, especially after your Disney-esque dreams, but how much longer can you do this?
I'd say about a month at that point. We don't really have a fallback location to go to if we end up out of a house. I don't own a vehicle right now. I would say that I either need to have some kind of income coming in the next few weeks, or I really don't know, what's next for me.
We will we'll call you back in the new year, Neil, and we'll see how you're doing. That's Neil Cairns up in Portland, Oregon, from our series, The United States of Work. Best of luck, Neil. We'll talk soon, okay?
Thanks, Kai. Oh,
The end for the internal combustion engine is nigh, or at least nearer, over in Britain. The government there has moved up its ban on sales of new gas and diesel vehicles from 2040 to 2030. It would make the UK number two, behind Norway, in the global move to outlaw gas-powered cars and trucks. So how is the planned ban going down out in the English countryside? From southern England, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
In the very traditional village of Quainton, with its thatched cottages and its windmill on the green, Paul Tunnicliffe prepares for a spin in his very traditional motor car. A 1933 Fraser Nash sports car, a fossil-fuelled beauty.
Six-cylinder, single overhead camshaft, three carburettors. And
while Tunnicliffe revels in the technical specs, it's pretty clear this vehicle is the love of his life.
You build quite a strong emotional rapport with a car like this. Effectively, it's part of the family, and whenever I sell a car, which thankfully isn't too often, it's a massive wrench in my life.
Tunnicliffe, who's president of the Vintage Sports Car Club, would be aghast if he were ever prohibited from driving his beloved Fraser Nash, but he's certainly not opposed to the ban on the sale of new fossil-fueled cars.
The willful destruction of the planet cannot continue unabated, so times move on and we have to move with them.
An unexpected sentiment, perhaps, from a vintage car enthusiast, but it is surprising how widespread support for the ban seems to be. Here's Paul Mauerhoff, a spokesman for the UK auto industry.
We welcome the ambition. I mean, I think the industry wants to move towards zero-emission motoring because it's invested, you know, significantly in this technology.
And less surprisingly, Luke Murphy of the progressive think tank, the IPPR, is also enthusing about the ban.
It sends an important signal to the world that the UK is getting serious about tackling the climate crisis and meeting its net zero challenge.
But the enthusiasm is tempered with realism. Auto industry spokesman Paul Mauerhoff points out that currently only 5% of new cars sold in the UK are electric.
So now we're looking at moving that to effectively 100% in 9 years. So that really gives a sense of scale to this challenge, which is immense.
He says it'll only happen if there's a multi-billion dollar increase in public spending on subsidies for the purchase of electric cars and promotion of a vital new industry that is just beginning to stir.
You turn up, you take the charger out of its socket, you connect it to the car.
The UK's first all-electric recharging station in Great Notley, near the town of Braintree. With 36 chargers, it's due to open next month. The boss, Toddington Harper, is delighted with the new ban.
Within 9 years, we are transitioning entirely, so it's going to be illegal to buy a petrol or a diesel car. This really is a tremendous opportunity. It's going to be good for the environment, and it's clearly going to be great for business too.
He's planning 100 new all-electric stations within the next 5 years. He was predestined for this project. 60 years ago, his father built gas stations and named his sons Toddington and Heston after two of the UK's freeway rest stops. Now Toddington Harper has built the first electric equivalent here at Braintree.
Are you going to name your next child Braintree?
Well, actually, I have four little girls. They're wonderful. They got born during the period I was building a lot of solar projects. So they all have, you know, middle names along the lines of Sunshine. And
that's a relief. They're not going to be burdened with Braintree. Or even worse, Great Notley.
I think Braintree and Great Notley are wonderful names.
He's confident he'll still be laughing 9 years from now and that his vision will pay off. In Braintree, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. It has been a while since the fiscal peril that states and cities face in this corona economy has been top of mind, so we will put it back there. A report from the National League of Cities out this week shows that on average, cities have seen revenues decline 21% since the pandemic started. Expenses, meanwhile, have gone up 17% over the same time period. Now, yes, the National League of Cities is a lobbying group for cities, but as you heard from that guy in Sabree's piece, among the sticking points in whatever it is Congress is doing on relief is whether to give those cities any help. All right, we got to go, but not without your midweek moment of economic context. Comes to us from the Census Bureau today, a short turnaround survey they do called the Household Pulse Survey. Data for the period November 11th through 23rd came out today. Lots in there. One quick item, which is kind of on the theme of this program today, is help coming for this economy. Almost 31% of people, this survey reports, expect somebody in their household is going to lose employment income in the next month. That's a third of Americans going to lose income from a job between now and Christmas. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They're coming into the studio so the rest of us don't have to unless our home internet is terrible. I'm Kai Rizdahl. See you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.